Good morning, all. Welcome so many back again. And to continue our study. Monday, we suggested the context in which we find the voice of the silence as part of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. And today I'd like to get a little bit further, I hope, into the voice, into at least something of the first fragment. One of the points that might be mentioned is that in Buddhist canonical literature, there are two main groups. And I think it's helpful to recognize this. There are what are known as the sutras, S-U-T-R-A-S, sutras. Sutra really means thread. And actually, we have it in the English word suture, you know, when you get sewn up after an operation and so on. So it's not unknown. In English, it's rather interesting. These are, of course, said to be the most important works because they are considered to be the discourses delivered by the Buddha himself, or in some cases by his disciples, the arhats or bodhisattvas, speaking either with his approval or with his inspiration. And the method of the sutra method as it's often spoken of, is of course a direct, aphoristic, intuitional method. And one finds this, of course, in Hindu literature also, the sutras, the Yoga Sutras, for example, is the title of Patanjali's work. And they aim at, indeed, what I've said this text is aimed at, of coming awake, awakening, a spiritual awakening, not just an intellectual conviction, but to awaken a spiritual understanding. The other class of texts are called the Shastras, S-A-S-T-R-A-S, Shastras, which are commentarial, they're discursive, they're logical, and they appeal much more, perhaps, to the rational mind. And we may say that although the voice of the silence certainly does not claim to be the utterance of the Buddha, that it is really a sutra text. It's aphoristic, it's direct, it's intuitional, and therefore it is not so much non-rational or irrational, it's certainly not irrational, but it appeals to something beyond the rational mind. And I think often, therefore, our problem comes in attempting to understand it in the normal way in which we understand most texts, and particularly for us in the West who are accustomed to an intellectual understanding, and we want to be sure, you know, this makes sense, we say, and what is the logic behind this, and also that we're very often accustomed to taking words very literally. I often think of a statement of the Jungian James Hillman, which has always appealed to me, literalness is sickness. And I think to a large extent the literal mind is often a kind of sickness. And perhaps, without in any way denigrating our Christian brethren, the literalists, you know, who say that every word in the Bible must be taken literally, there is a kind of a sickness to that kind of fundamentalism, that we have to look behind the words, and particularly in this case, where we recognize that this is a translation. HPB is very frank about it. She didn't invent it. She didn't write it out in English from her own imagination. She says it's a translation. So obviously she had to make choices on words. And I think we can get the beauty of her own mind in what she attempted to do in this, that to translate it. But also she was, I think we have to recognize that she had to use the language that was available to her. And often the words that had meaning in the last century have different meanings today and different connotations today, don't they? Our whole language structure continuously changes. And we also have to recognize, and I think that's one of the delights in here at the Crotona School, we have students from other parts of the world. And English is not always spoken the same in New Zealand as it is in the United States. Is that right, Mary? And sometimes words have different meanings. Probably also in Kenya, English words have different meanings, and certainly in India. So we have, and with a Japanese background, Hatsu, you probably are familiar with this. So we have the fact that words have different meanings, that this is a translation, that we do not have available to us the original, and so we're dealing with a real text, which is what I call a psycho-spiritual shock treatment. That it really is designed to awaken us, but to awaken us to something that is beyond the mind, and yet does not indicate that we are to be mindless in approaching it. So we have a lot of problems that confront us. I think we also have to recognize that in Buddhism, there is an equal validity given to the rational processes, the psychological processes of consciousness, and to experience, and that actually there are two types of meditational experience. One which we can call mundane, the meditational experience that deals with the observation of that which is presented to us, and transcendental meditational experience. And I think, again, the voice of the silence helps us to see that those two types of meditational experience are both possible. We'll look at this a little bit further. But I wanted to, therefore, point out that the voice of the silence not only uses the sutra method, but by its very nature, it is paradoxical. And so it uses paradox as a method. And indeed, many of the Buddhist scriptural texts, the Prajnaparamita above all, in which this is in the same tenor as the Prajnaparamita, because it points to the Bodhisattva path, paradox is necessary. And we're uncomfortable with paradox very often, aren't we? We want things either this way or that way. And we have to look at a both and situation. And I think this may be helpful in just, I would really like to make it in a sense of a meditative experience for you, and hope that it will be. I thought I might begin by looking a little more closely at the title, because I think this is not a title that was suddenly, you know, HPB said, now what shall I call this? I mean, this is my own view. Those of you who know HPB's literature may have other views about it, and that's fine. But I can't imagine HPB saying to herself, let's give it a name that's going to confuse all of my students henceforth. Maybe she did, I don't know. Dara, how do you think she did?
No, I don't think she did.
I don't think she did.
She arrived at it that manner.
I don't think she did. I think that there is a very deep, mystical understanding that is implied in the title itself, The Voice of the Silence. And that strange juxtaposition points to, of course, the paradox. Does silence have a voice? Can there be a voice that is silence? And so on. So I suggest that we can look at this and examine it, but examine it in the light of that doctrine which I pointed to on Monday, which is central to the Buddhist tradition, the doctrine of shunyata, or sometimes translated emptiness, suchness, essence-ness, the quality that is its original essence, which of course may be then genuine silence. There is therefore in our very title both a passive and a dynamic, both a state in which there is the reaching of an equilibrium inside us, a no thought state, to use the Zenish term if you like, a state which is passive, which is silence, and a state which is dynamic, that is moving outward, which is the voice. And the balance, we can speak of it as I did on Monday. The two major themes of Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism, as prajna, wisdom, and of karuna as compassion, and they are linked by upaya, or skillful means, how we bring it about. Silence in this case then becomes passive. It is the feminine container, if you like. You could put feminine and masculine, if you like, in a sense. These are, but silence is the matrix. Silence is the matrix which nourishes sound. So it's rather interesting to note that the great 17th century French mystic, Madame Guyon, said there are four kinds of silence, and I think these are pointed to in The Voice of the Silence. The first three are probably easily recognizable. The silence of sound. What sounds do we make as we move through the world? This is not just, you know, sound of speech, but, you know, what sound, I think it's related to the physical realm. We are not very silent physically, you know. And I'm not just talking about chomping food and that, you know, eating celery and so on. But rather, our bodies are all the time in motion. And the fact that we know, for example, that every atom of our being has its own particular resonance, so that the very physical body is all the time sounding. It's a composition of the atoms, and therefore it has its own resonance. So the silence of sound is bringing, of course, the physical vehicle into a certain receptive condition. This is why, of course, in Tantrayana Buddhism. In the Tantrayana tradition, a great deal, as in Hatha Yoga, a great deal of attention is paid to bringing the physical vehicle into a passive condition, into quiet, into equilibrium. Very essential. This is part of the whole tradition of the East, isn't it? To really be able to bring about the silence of sound, of the physical sound. We'll be talking more about this Friday when we get into, it's Friday, isn't it, the sounds of the self. The silence of desires obviously refers to the psychic realm, the kama manasic realm, the realm of kama particularly. We may bring the physical vehicle into a nice harmonious condition, but we still are chattering away at the desire level, wanting all sorts of things, grasping all sorts of things, feeling the need of, you see, of comfort, of desire for comfort, all of the desires that sway us. So there is the silence of desires. The silence of thoughts, of course, belongs to the world of discursive thought and investigation. And this, quite obviously, also has to do with the fact that that aspect of the mind cannot, by its very nature then, approach reality. Mind is the slayer of the real. It cannot, by its very nature, the discursive mind, the mind, what I think can be called the chattering mind, the gossipy mind, the mind that's always interrupting us, interrupting the steady flow of thought, the mind that suddenly says, ah, I ought to have done that. Oh, there's the telephone. I forgot to do this, and so on. The chattering mind, the silence of thought. Now the silence of will, which is indeed the entry to that genuine experience of sunyata, is maybe said to be a kind of ultimate silence. The cessation of the faintest vestige of self-consciousness or ego sense. This can be regarded, I think, as equivalent to the realization, as I say, of sunyata. One of the most striking features of the Madhyamaka philosophy of Nagarjuna. It's interesting, sunya is probably the most difficult term in all Buddhist philosophy to interpret. And it has been interpreted by some Western scholars as simply nihilism, which is unfortunate. But it is an extremely difficult. Etymologically, it's derived from the root svi, S-V-I, which means to swell and to expand. Curiously enough, the same meaning as the root verb for Brahman. Generally, it's translated, therefore, as the void, which is also the fullness. It is nothing in particular, and therefore has it in it the possibility of everything. So it has been identified with nirvana, with the absolute, and so on. It is that experience, said Nagarjuna, which cannot be imparted one to another. Cannot be imparted. It is unaffected by the empirical mind, transcendent to discursive thought. It is non-dual, non-expressible. So it, as Nagarjuna put it, for him who accepts sunyata, everything stands in its proper place within the harmonious whole. And for him who does not accept sunyata, everything is out of joint. Is that a wonderful thing? So, it's really that ultimate silence, the emptiness and the suchness present in all things. So here is a condition towards which we, the voice of the silence directs us, a genuine, an interior silence that is so all-pervasive that one's very being resonates in complete harmony without any disjointure whatsoever with the universe, with that which underlies the universe. So that, you know, I think often of a statement that he will appear in the eyes of the world as nothing, you know. That, and yet his presence is all pervasive. This, of course, is the presence of the Buddha, isn't it? All pervasive, and yet not particularized at any point. Incredible. Well, this is the ideal. Someone said, you know, it's not easy to realize. Well, nobody said it was going to be easy.
Mm-hmm. Is this some state that some people actually live at all the time? Does this happen sporadically?
I think we come at it sporadically. I think we do. But I think that the ideal is that for the Bodhisattva, that is the continuing consciousness, the abiding consciousness. But it's true. And I think, you know, the only way, after all, we're on our way. We're midway in the human condition, aren't we? We're all midway. The human life wave is midway in the human condition. The whole human life wave is midway in the human condition. Fourth round, fifth race, you know, all the rest of it. You know all of that from the sacred doctrine. Our point of entry is right here and now. You know, we've made it this far, so to speak, and in the whole cycle of this manvantara.
How would svabhava be related to that? Would it be on the passive side of Srinivasa?
Yes, yes.
Or would it be on the objectless? I see you have it down there.
Yes.
Also, again, under dynamic.
Yes,
Would it be related?
I think it's very much related. And generally, it's said to be related to the silence, svabhava, the marvelous concept of svabhava, the self-beingness, isn't it? Now, if it's self-becomingness, It comes here much more, but the self-beingness, which is the way I interpret it. How do you interpret it?
Well, I was always puzzled with some of my point Loma friends, hearing them speak about, well, that's his particular svabhava.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, now that would be his essential nature, mm-hmm. the way they were using it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but it's that essential nature which is, according to the third fundamental proposition of the sacred doctrine, identical, not similar to, not something like, but identical with the universal. And yet for the purposes of, this is where it gets very tricky, I think it gets a little tricky insofar as words are concerned. For the purposes of the presence in the world, there is a voluntary self-limitation. The Bodhisattva, in other words, is that individual who remains with the world. And this, of course, is the goal of the, and we'll talk more about the Bodhisattva path when we come to the two paths, you know. Because that is the path that is proposed, HVB's proposal, that we become as, I think the statement that we have in the voice, which is so, so magnificent, that self-doomed, this is in the Seven Portals, final fragment, self-doomed. In other words, it is a voluntary sacrifice to live through future kalpas unthanked and unperceived by men. This is verse 293, if you have one that has the numbered verses, wedged as a stone with countless other stones which form the guardian wall, such is thy future, built by the hands of many masters of compassion, raised by their tortures, by their blood cemented. It shields mankind, since man is man, protecting it from further and far greater misery and sorrow. That wedged as a stone, that self-being which is still present in the world, has taken upon self-doomed, marvelous phrase. And I think true, coming back to yours, Alice, I think it is true that the possibility of this is always glimpsed. If it were not possible, you see, the ideal is there, yes. And as Browning said, a man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for, you see. So the ideal is there, but the possibility of its achievement is glimpsed. And there are moments when we know, when we absolutely know we are in absolute harmony. And it's as though one were seated, let me put it this way, it's as though one were seated by the edge of a river, and the stream is flowing by, and someone passes and doesn't even see you, but feels a presence. Can we put it that way? That, and you, because you know you are so one with the flowing river, with the tree on the bank, with the water's edge, you are so absolutely one that you are invisible, as it were. Because not even the physical body is making a sound. And there can be such moments, can't there? And this is why it is said, you see, that the very first step, the very beginning, which must take place here, is with the very thought that this is possible, what is known as bodhicitta. The very thought that illumination, that awakening is possible. The very, however evanescent, however transitory that thought, you know, for one moment, you know, you see, that it's possible. I've those of you who know how much I love the Grail legends, I always think of Parzival, who had this vision, who saw it, didn't realize all that would have to take place, all the struggle and all of the dangers and everything else, but who would say, "Go, I will, cost what it may." And that statement, because there has been for one moment, at least, that vision, "Go, I will, cost what it may." So it starts, it is said, the whole path starts with the thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta.
Now, I think there were two questions. One was asked of Buddha, the other was asked of Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti's answer was who he was. And he said, "I'm mankind." And Buddha said, when he asked if he was a man, he said, "No, I'm awake." And that was only two words. Two words seemed to convey what that voice was silent, or at least I assume it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you see, it's what's called in the Buddhist text that the Buddha maintained a noble silence. The phrase is frequently used, sometimes in some translations, an Aryan silence is maintained. But in one of the great, in among the sayings of the Buddha, one of his chief disciples has said with regard to this, what means this noble silence that the Buddha maintained? When he was asked certain questions, he maintained a noble silence, or an Aryan silence. one of his two chief disciples, Moggallana the Great, "Then, friends, I thus thought, herein a brother, by the suppression of discursive thought and investigation, enters on and abides in the second state of internal calm of heart, concentrated on its object, free from discursive thought and investigation, born of mental balance, a state of zest and ease. This is called the Aryan silence, or the noble silence. Arya, of course, means noble. But isn't that a state of zest and ease, is the particular translation that has been given there. State of that's both dynamic and restful. Incredible, you see. Again, paradox.
I've noticed in many of the Mahayana sutras, whenever Buddha is silent, they always say, well, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he always produces something. It may be
yes.
a bad vision,
mm-hmm.
or maybe blessings, but something comes
something
forth.
Comes forth,
a lot
yes.
of energy and creativity.
Yes. So that there's both energy and creativity, zest. I think it's interesting. And at the same time, this perfect repose, this perfect centeredness, you know. And perhaps that's another term that can be used, you see. Sometimes when we're asked a question, we get all agitated, you see. Can we speak from this centeredness that is both creative and never out of balance? This is that silence. It's amazing. And so it is also said of the Buddha that even when he spoke, he was silent.
Everybody heard him in their own
manner. Yes. That even when he spoke, he was silent. And that when he was silent, he spoke. His silence spoke. So it's both. Wonderful. So we can, you see, we, you know, it's true. It's an ideal at this stage, but the possibility is there. Well, then consider then the term voice, because I think in all traditions, as we know, speech or the voice has symbolized creation, the creative potential. Every great religious tradition has this as primary for the creative potency is sound or speech, the word. And so again, sunyata can be regarded in this light. It does not possess, but rather it is by its very nature creative. Not exercising a creative function, but by its very nature, dynamic and creative. And the dynamic aspect is known then as karuna, compassion. And it is said that there are three kinds of karuna, therefore the dynamic, because the voice of the silence tells us, compassion is no attribute, it is the law of laws, eternal harmony. So it's not an attribute, but it is the word itself is compassion. It is love, if you like. This is the paradox, wonderful paradox, I think. And so it is said that there are three kinds. There is, first of all, that compassion, which has as its objects the beings who suffer. This, of course, is tainted. This is not the genuine one, because what is it tainted by? By the belief in the reality of living beings, in the separateness. So when you have as your object the beings who suffer, you are giving reality to other beings. You are saying there is someone out there to be pitied, so to speak. And that, of course, is a kind of tainted. So the voice then is used to pity, to love, to give compassion to beings, but you are by that very fact acknowledging that there is a reality in separate beings. So then the higher, the next stage, which is often called the higher karuna, the second stage of karuna, is said to be the has as its object painful sensations themselves. No point, I think, in giving you the Sanskrit terms. I'll leave those out. But the person who experiences this kind of dynamic, compassion, voice, resonance, experience knows that beings do not exist, but only their constituent psychophysical phenomena, the skandhas, in other words, as they are known in Buddhism. But this is still an approximation to true knowledge, for the painful sensations do not exist in themselves. So there is a kind of ignorance present even in this, you see. So it is said that there is a third kind of compassion, third aspect, which is pure compassion, which has no object. This, it is said, is the perfect compassion, which is, it's like the sun. In other words, the sun shines for all. The sun doesn't say, oh dear, Alice wasn't so good yesterday.
Discriminatory
sun. And so I'm not going to give her any sunshine today, you see. Or too much or something, you see. The sun is simply shining. The sun is simply there, isn't it? And so the Bodhisattva is simply there. His presence is there. And it doesn't matter whether there are painful sensations or whether there are objects undergoing painful sensations, the Bodhisattva's presence is simply there. This, of course, is not easy. And so it is, of course, I think, really in one sense, a recognition. It's said, for example, well, let me put it this way. When we come to the Trikaya, the three vestures, which I want to talk about whenever it is, a week from today, I guess it is, the three vestures. Anyway, one of the series. And it is said that the Bodhisattva wears the Dharmakaya vesture, the vesture of Dharma, the vesture of truthfulness. And in that, he is then all, what we can say is all things to all people, if you like, that his presence radiates, simply radiates. It is non-discriminatory. It doesn't say you're worthy, or it doesn't assign thingness at any point. I think there's a very close relationship between these three types of karuna, these three types. Now, I want to say a further word about why I'm equating it with voice. With the three categories of love in the Greco-Christian tradition. In Greek, you know, there are three words for love. And I think we can see that this is still true. There is eros, there is that love which is of beings. There is what is it, not amor, well, use the Latin term amor, or agape is the highest, yes. I was trying to think of the Greek term for the second one, but keratos is Latin, but it's the same thing. It becomes that, keratos. It is the caring for that which hurts, you see. It is a deeper caring. Philos is the Greek, philos. We have it in philosophy, which is a unique kind of love for wisdom. So we have eros, which is for beings, for sentient beings. Philos, which is for that which is experienced by beings, put it that way, the experienceable, in which we all share, the sufferings in which we all share, you see. And then there is agape, which is the highest, which is without any object, in which one really, you know, and I think this is the only thing that makes sense of that mystical statement. You remember of Jesus in the garden when he asks Peter, or he asks his disciples, I guess it is, three times, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And in our English Bible, you know, it sounds a little stupid, you see. If somebody says, do you love me, you see, and I respond, yes, and they come back and say, do you love me? By the third time, I say, well, look here, I answered you the first time. Isn't that right? You become a little irritated. So the only meaning there is because we have only one word, which is love, you see. But in the Greek, there were three words, and so this makes sense of what Jesus was asking. He asks his disciples, do you love me? Is there a love for the individual who has incarnated the whole Christ spirit? Do you love me? Is there the love for all that I have suffered, for the sufferings, which you also will suffer, for the whole passion, in other words? Do you love me? That is, do you really love the Christ? That is, are you seated in that compassion? So you have three forms, you see. And that alone makes sense of that very mysterious biblical statement, questions. And so here we have, as a resonance, think of voice then as that creative resonance. And this is the creative energy, which is compassion, which is love. The whole universe, the whole creative process has been brought together, has emerged, has been manifested through this resonance, which is compassion, which is love. So within the very title, you see, we have the whole aim of our the goal that is set before us. The whole aim that is there is right there in the title, Voice of the Silence. The creative energy of that which is by its own nature non-creative, but the creative energy of that suchness which is emptiness, the whole creative potency. And we reflect that in our being. We reflect that. We are seated in that. So I think by looking at the title itself, it's a profound meditation just to look at the title, The Voice of the Silence.
I was thinking about the great souls that experience other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have a question. They probably don't even have to like the person.
No.
So it's unconditional.
It's absolutely unconditional. Unconditional, yes. I think of that, you know, there's a beautiful Mass on the World written by Teilhard de Chardin. It's a wonderful one in his Hymn of the Universe. And in part of the opening of it, he calls before his mind, he says, "And I offer to you, O Lord," and so on, "I call before my mind all those whom you have given me and my immediate family to love. Then I call before me those in whose lives I have shared, in whose whole existence I have shared. And finally," he says, "I call before me and for love the whole vast anonymous army of humanity," which is unconditional, you know. "The whole vast anonymous army of humanity." I think it's a marvelous phrase that he uses there. And this is indeed that unconditional. One simply is. But it's a creative isness. Which is unconditional, you know. "Whole vast anonymous army of humanity." I think it's a marvelous phrase that he uses there. And this is indeed that unconditional. One simply is. But it's a creative isness. It's a radiating isness, because it's the voice, the sounding which is always going forth. The sounding which is always going. So we have just in the title, and I think so often we overlook this title, The Voice of the Silence, and forget what the deeper meaning may be. So I'd like to open that up a little bit for you. Okay, it's time for our break. Explore even further. Let us move then to the first fragment. Are there any questions or comments on what I suggested in the title, about the title, that anyone wants to share?
It seems like this move to growth of the Bodhisattva is really rooted down into a certain amount of selfishness. Mm-hmm. And then you gradually divest yourself with these steps to get to higher and higher growth.
This is true.
To centralize oneself. And so, in other words, like Chardin said, the first one considers the immediate group and then extend it further and further. And Shogun Trungpa said that excuse the expression, that one's shit becomes fertilizer for growth. So upon that not so desirable situation, you can actually use that to grow.
To grow, yes. Yes. It is grounded, you see, and it is all grounded in physical incarnation. This is the thing, this is the point. And of course, this is very clearly the esoteric teaching. Very clear in the secret doctrine that every step is taken in physical incarnation. So it is here that it has to be grounded. And what appears at one level to be repulsive, to be selfish, to be overcome, is indeed the stepping stone for the next level. Fertilizes, indeed, becomes the fertilizer for the growth that has to take place. Well, with this then, I think we can approach the text then as the upaya, or the means by which we do move in this progression. And it is said that the first fragment then, which is called, of course, the Voice of the Silence itself, it is said that it deals with the introductory path, often called the probationary path. It introduces us to a number of very wonderful concepts, not all of which we will have time to explore. The three halls, for example, we'll be looking at those a bit on Friday. the seven mystic sounds, which we will be discussing on Friday specifically, and the four modes of truth. So that the central theme, I suggest, of this first fragment that she gives us, which of course is consists of actually 100 aphorisms, 100 shlokas, 100 verses, the 100th of which is Om Tat Sat, that introduces us, I think, the central theme of it is the gradual freeing of the mind. Lowell has just said, the gradual freeing of consciousness from layer after layer of unreality. It's a process. And so it may be said that in this first fragment, a kind of centripetal note is struck. And it's indicated in the second verse, very beginning, that he who would hear the voice of nada, this is the soundless sound, this is the creative sound. Nada Brahma is the creative potency. This is the creative power. This is the creative centering of and comprehend it. He has to learn the nature of dharana, which is, of course, the bringing of the mind to a focus, really knowing what we're doing, giving attention. That's why I'm sorry that this little book is not yet available, but when it becomes available, do try to get it, Buddhist Meditation by Rinpoche, because he constantly emphasizes that the first step in meditation is to train the mind to concentrate on one point, on one object. Concentration is the first step, and again he discusses this, that the that we have to really learn what the mind is all about. The entire purpose is to be aware, to be aware of what we think, what we're thinking, constantly. So the very first is dharana, which is this focus of the mind, the fixing of the mind in a particular direction. It is said, as I pointed out at the beginning, that the very beginning of the whole path, the very starting point, is the awareness, the consciousness, citta, the knowing, the consciousness that illumination, awakening is possible. Bodhicitta, is said, is the first stage. So it is said that always in the back of one's mind, no matter what one may be doing, no matter what one may be engaged in, at the back of one's mind, one never loses sight of what it's all about. And that's why I suggested, reflect on what is the deepest motive in my life. Reflect on it. Don't answer it hurriedly. Just like the Bodhisattva vow, which ultimately is not a vow taken to anybody. It can't be. How can it be taken to anybody? And yourself become self-responsible. You can't answer this. That's why I said reflect. We're not going to discuss. We can discuss how we discover our motive, and I hope we'll have a moment to do that, and so on. But in the back of the mind constantly, no matter what one is doing, is this thought of coming awake, of enlightenment. And if that is the deepest motive, it is always present. It is always present. And when it's said, therefore, that when the mind is done with whatever it's been engaged in, the mind seems to be idle, it should turn to that thought. It should be so present that the thought then comes to the fore. So that it's always, but it's always intentionally present. This, in a sense, is what jhana means, Y-A-N-A, when we talk about Mahayana and Tantrayana, Yana is a path, but it's a path in the sense not of something external to ourselves, but a path in the sense that it's one's own orientated becoming. The project, put it this way, the project of myself is myself as I will be. So it's a path that is internalized. And of course, HPB makes this clear, you remember? Very clear, thou canst not travel on that path until thou hast become the path itself, which is verse 58. Thou canst not travel on the path before thou hast become that path itself. This is our own being. So it's always intentionally present in one's consciousness. Now, central to this, then, is the statement in verses 19 and 20. Saith the great law, in order to become the knower of all self, thou hast first of self to be the knower. To reach the knowledge of that self, thou hast to give up self to non-self, being to non-being, and then thou canst repose between the wings of the great bird. Bestride the bird of life if thou wouldst know. Now it's an interesting statement, because when you bestride a bird, you're in a central position, aren't you? You're not on one wing or the other. You have come to a central position. It's interesting to compare this with Arjuna's statement to his charioteer in the very first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, when he, you know, is standing at one side, one army, and he looks across the field and he sees a lot of relatives and friends and aunts, uncles, and cousins, etc., over there. And he doesn't talk to that central principle in himself from that side. He says, take me to the center. And this is the key to the whole Gita, I think, is there in the first chapter. Take me to the center where I can observe everything, you see. Now here we have it. Bestride the bird of life, which is to be in the center, to be on the body of the bird. Because you're at the center, you see. So this is extremely important. It's to take up an inner attitude, which is represented by, of course, here, the symbol of the great bird, which is identified here with the Om. I, sweet is rest between the wings of that which is not born nor dies, but is the Aum throughout eternal ages. Now, it is said that this word, Aum, here A-U-M, is the most complete word as to sound it in full. We use all the gamut of speech, from throat, center of the mouth, and the lips. A-U-M. So the whole gamut of speech, it is said, is used. The three letters are also said to represent the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and all, therefore, it is a sound that produces, that is creative, is dynamic, and it is said that, therefore, it's a four-syllabled word, the A-U-M and the Ardhamatra, which is the half syllable at the conclusion of it. It's therefore, the past, present, and future is established in that whole sound. The Upanishads speak of it as the bird Hamsa. Let's see if I don't get too tangled up. Yes. Get over that far. It is the bird Hamsa. Yes, so I had put that on. And this is a very interesting word. Hamsa is the swan, of course. There are various, it's the mythological bird, which is supposed to have the capacity of separating milk from water. That is, that which is real from unreal. The quality of discrimination, separating the essence from the non-essence, truth from false, and so on. The Hamsa, therefore, according to HPB, symbolizes inherent wisdom, divine wisdom, or wisdom in darkness beyond the reach of ordinary man. The Upanishads speak of the ah as the right wing, the u as the left wing, the m as the tail, and the ardhamatra as the head. The legs of the bird are the three gunas, qualities of matter, sattva, rajas, and tamas. The body is truth. The right eye is dharma. The left eye, adharma. The feet, the physical plane. The hips of the bird. Did you know that the bird has hips? Is the mental level. The navel is the buddhic. The heart, the atmic. The throat, anupadika. And between the eyebrows and forehead, adi. So the bird in the Upanishads represents this bird. The entire range, therefore, of human incarnation. The word, of course, is subject to many interpretations. In one of the Puranas, for example, the second aspect of the Trinity is depicted as Hamsa, the sound of whose breathing is the magic melody of the creation and dissolution of the world. So that it's related to sound, so that it's most interesting of all, I think, Hamsa is an important symbol because in its mode of life, it exhibits the twofold nature of all beings. The Hamsa, or swan, swims on water but is not bound by it, like the fish and other water animals. So swims on the water but is not bound by it. The water of manifestation, the water of the unconscious. Water, of course, has many, many symbolic meanings. Psychologically, it's the unconscious. And this is on the unconscious, but is not bound by it. Withdrawing from the realm of the waters, it flies into pure space, where it is as much at home as in the world below. So the Hamsa symbolizes the free, homeless wanderer with the true realization of freedom. The homeless wanderer. His home is everywhere. And we must become the Hamsa then. We become this bird. It symbolizes the divine essence, which though embodied in each individual, is still forever free and unconcerned with the events of the individual's life. Hence, a person who has reached a certain stage in evolution is called Hamsa and Param, Paramahamsa. So one of the Paramahamsa is a free wanderer in the inner sense, not born in this world out of necessity. He is stainless, like the white swan, the Hamsa, free from all material discolorings of this world, without likes and dislikes. In time, in manifestation, it is the Kalahamsa, the swan in time. So we have both the swan out of time and the swan in time. And so it's said in the Upanishads that Hamsa, as a symbol of the divine essence or the divine self in the body of this universe, manifests itself through a song. And when a yogi does pranayama during the inhaling and exhaling, he hears the rhythm of this breath as the manifestation of this divine melody of Hamsa, of the song. And it's interesting in how many traditions, how many mythologies, there's a kind of siren song which pulls us into manifestation, into the realm of desire, the siren song. And then there is the heavenly song, that pulls us to the other side. It's interesting if you read many of the myths to notice this, how many have siren songs that get the person, get the hero all involved, you know, and off the beaten track, you see. And we listen to the siren songs of all of our desires. Or we listen to the cosmic song that pulls us on. It's interesting, it's said that that Hamsa is a word of tremendous potency. It is equivalent, for example, to, if it's said rapidly, to Ahamsa, so that one begins to, this A becomes that A, as it were, you see. And in repeating this, Ahamsa, Soham, Soham, becomes Soham, 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 Soham. It becomes he is I or that am I. And so the very repetition of it explains the whole mystery of one's being, the nature and the mystery of ourselves, that in essence we are that. And if you begin to say it, when repeated continuously, Soham, 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 I am that, that am I. So it's this presence then that we are to bestride, and therefore to come to know the self. Thou hast first of self to be the knower. We have to know who we are. And this truth, it is said, the eternal mention, the eternal message, Hamsa, Sahamsa, 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 I am that, in our limited consciousness, this truth is sung to us by our own breath at every moment of exhalation and inhalation. So we are constantly reminded.
You know that Paramahansa Yogananda, who introduced self-realization, he suggests when you're starting meditation to watch your breath. And
yes.
With the inhalation, you say, hum, sa, exhalation.
That's right.
Sa.
Yes. And Rinpoche mentions this, that a very good way to begin the whole process of dharana, or concentration, is the breath, to use the breath to watch one's breathing. I don't see it right now, but he mentions this indeed. So it's very true. And if you do that, the cosmic song is being sung to you with your very breath, reminding you that I am that, that am I. So you can do it. Begin to follow it. Now, because it says to therefore bestride the bird of life, if thou wouldst know, and therefore here is the bird, Hamsa, which is our very being, to bestride it, to come to the center of our being, I've asked a couple of questions. How then do we discover our motive? How do we begin to discover what is our deepest motive? Not telling us what is, because you cannot really say what is your deepest motive, because that is an interior realization. But how do we begin to discover our deepest motive? Dara?
Interesting that you mentioned the Bhagavad Gita, where often Krishna tells Arjuna, let the motive be in the action itself. Then you mentioned also the fact that we need to know about the non-being,
yes,
idea. In the process of doing that which lies before one to do, free of any self-interest motive, but becoming dispassionate, or as you said earlier, getting rid of all the extraneous desires and business of thought, is the action of what lies before us. Has a quality of stilling something interior, so that the real motive you can become part of that extreme dimension. We all have this constantly going, the self, the universal stream of life is compassionate automatically, almost like if we lived in harmony with all of life and nature, we really believed ourselves to be one, how could we wish to harm anyone? So still, you said we had, there were two types of meditation, one that attending to that which confronts us, so mm-hmm. we meet that stream using the method of the Bhagavad Gita where we do that which lies before us in our selflessness, mm-hmm. that stills the other life, and then we stream, mm-hmm. we become more aware of that. Mm-hmm. Somehow it's an alchemy.
It's an alchemy, isn't it? Yes, it really is, isn't that? Joyce?
In the book, I think Robert that came to do is precisely what you've done. Start out with a quiet and a breath. And then one asks oneself inside, what is it I want to focus on?
Mm-hmm.
And that what is going on in my life is present.
Mm-hmm.
But as these things come forward, one looks exactly as you described it, and it's difficult to find the body is still. Then as you go through the, beneath the surface of those things, you find out eventually what it is, and become aware of our own path, our own mm-hmm. progress, our own passage.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple to put. You said, it's a matter of focusing in, quieting down, and asking something.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it is possible to do it that way, to look within and discover a little bit. I think it's much more difficult. I think we're liable to deceive ourselves. So I think it's better just to rely on what do we do in our life ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
What are our daily actions are, if that's what our motive is,
mm-hmm.
in spite of the motive that we have in the big
hell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Brent.
it may not just be our activity that helps us to know the motive, but it may be in energy exerted by the Lord itself on us
yes.
to realize it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good point. There may be an interior energy in the whole process, as it were, exerting its influence on us. That's a very good point, Brenda. Yes.
So you know, I think in agreement with this idea that we can a practical and very reliable way to find our motives is to look at what we do rather than what we say. But that could take a long time to get down to our deepest matter, because we do a lot of things that aren't related to our deepest matter. And so I think then that silence is the real thing. Put these other competing claims aside and in silence try and find what they mean. And then I think we will hopefully find the broad matter, the one related to all life.
What about the possibility of just electing a motive?
Mm-hmm.
Not arbitrary, but through some thought and evaluation, decide that one would try this as a motive in one's life, or as a philosophy of life,
mm-hmm.
and see where that takes you. And then through adjustment and so on, because it says that, you know, it takes eons to become a Buddha, for even a Bodhisattva
yes.
to become a Buddha,
yes.
Because you're always, there's the most subtle of cleanings
uh-huh.
that just take eons to come into touch with.
Uh-huh.
So we may never be able to discover that in my lifetime, but to take the some tried and true pathways or for teachings
uh-huh.
that have worked, have some tradition, and then to and then to give them a try and see what
that's a, I think that's a, you see, there are many ways. I think this is where, you know, we have to be open to the fact that there are many ways, and perhaps just to sort of try one on for size and work with it for a while.
Well, I think we were talking about at least two things. One is, what is karma,
uh-huh.
as we express
yes.
it.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, what is it within, or
uh-huh.
what shall it be?
Yes.
And that's, you know, you can do that consciously.
Yes.
You just have a sense of vows that are very practical
mm-hmm.
and helpful.
Oh, yeah.
To remind you to
mm-hmm.
focus on whatever you
can. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's why I said, how do we discover it? There are many ways to discover it, perhaps. May?
Yes.
From my own personal experience, I get pushed around. Mm-hmm. I go in one direction, that's not the right direction, mm-hmm. and I get pushed in another direction, mm-hmm. and so forth. I do meditate, I know my life is, for me, it's being directed by other means.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go the wrong way, then I get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, yes. Interesting, Virginia.
In our very action, isn't there a little voice that we can call conscience that reveals mm-hmm. more of our motive than we possibly have been aware of mm-hmm. in the very action?
Mm-hmm. So it's paying attention to that voice then. It's really, again, dharana, giving attention, focusing on it, and listening. Because part of dharana, part of concentration is listening.
I don't think you can even do it alone either. I think you either in Buddhism they have a spiritual friend
mm-hmm.
or a group or a community of students and some organization called fellowship where you can speak freely or more and more freely as you become more secure of yourself,
mm-hmm.
so that you aren't sort of blown around, or you have good feedback and good reinforcement, and you do. I think you need somebody else, because listening inside and can be good for certain techniques, mm-hmm. but I think it's difficult to be honest with yourself and just open to see the trees through the forest. It's superhuman as far as.
I think what you've touched on is a very important point, because it's true for in the Buddhist tradition, a major help towards the Bodhisattva, a major step is what's known as Kalyana Mitra, the good friend. Having a good friend, that is, or being a good friend, which is not someone who exploits you, somebody who uses you, or in any way, but what is the good friend, you see? But this is an important part of the whole process in Mahayana Buddhism, is Kalyana Mitra. I think it's a wonderful phrase, the good friend, the really good in the Platonic sense of good.
But the good friend doesn't necessarily have to mean another person.
No.
It is within the self.
Mm-hmm. Can be. But it's also in relationship. But also it's in relationship. I think it comes back to what you said, May, too. You know, we may get pushed around, but in that very pushing, we discover our center, don't we? But it is in relationship. We were not meant to be in isolation. The Bodhisattva path is not a path of the aloneness. That's the Trajika Buddha path.
In fact, the Bodhisattva path is, you know, you say, to seek enlightenment for yourself and to help all sentient beings attain that
mm-hmm.
That state of enlightenment mm-hmm. as well. And it's not so much, you can't possibly get all sentient mm-hmm. beings to that state, but you're constantly working with other human beings, other sentient beings. You are always, you have to learn, you have to study, and a lama told me once that mm-hmm. one meditates to help oneself, but you study to help other people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Don't you think music will eventually reach a point where it'll get so advanced that the magical note will help mankind all over?
This may be. I don't know. No idea what direction music's going in. I would hesitate to say what direction. But you see, this also in this, Azella?
I think today music is already there. All we have to do is tune into it.
I mean, you can sit in a beautiful opera, in a beautiful symphony, or any kind of beautiful music, and become not yourself at all if you concentrate on it. So I think the music, the sound is already in music. I don't think it has to be evolved to something. We have to evolve to the awareness that it's there.
In all of this, you see, that's why it may seem that this second question is not related, but it really is, you see, because in this, and coming back, May said, you know, we feel pushed around at times. When we, you see, bestride the bird of life that thou wouldst know, considering it this, at this center, the alm, where repose is, but is all experience necessary? This indeed became one of the great debates after the Light on the Path was issued in 1886. That it said, you know, you must experience everything. And so does this mean we have to all, you know, be murderers, or do we have to? Do we all have to experience everything? Okay.
Well, with the world being one and everything being whole. We can see now with our ways of communicating that what affects my brother over here affects me too. So we may be experiencing all on all different levels.
How much is enough? I think there are people who need to have the same lesson 50 times and others who get the message the first time. But then also I think that we can all experience and must experience, say killing without actually being a physical murderer, because there are ways in which we can kill with our mind or do that thing which could lead to killing and then experience the result of it. So I'm trying to think that we need to experience all types of experience without necessarily every necessary behavior.
But
actualizing
that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And through love and compassion, isn't there a resonance, though, that comes back and through that resonance you are experiencing other.
I'll follow that. Say it again.
That through love and compassion, through compassion, becoming other, there is a resonance.
And that identifying comes, with others?
It's beyond identifying. It's a becomingness. Identifying would be a mental process, I think. Whereas this is a quality that evokes a resonance, and through that resonance, we experience other than what we go through in our day-to-day lives. I don't know that I can express it.
It's something to think about, you see, because when you say all experience, now this can be taken again in perhaps two ways. In other words, experience all what Murray referred to as nitty-gritty, but details, all events. Or is experience, is this thou hast first of self to be the knower, to really reach that knowledge, to really know ourselves. We also have to know of what we are capable under any circumstances, you know, so that one can say there may be only a very few real lessons to be learned in being human, only a very few, but there are an infinite variety of ways in which those lessons may be presented to us. Those would be the nitty-gritty details.
That would be point B.
Yes.
Painful sensations.
Yes.
Which are just finding themselves expressed in human beings because the human beings are yet too weak to recognize flowing through.
Mm-hmm.
Really, if Virginia means resonance in the sense of saying, well, isn't it a pity that these people think they can destroy an idea by trying to assassinate Salman Rushdie, who wrote The Time of Persons? Do they really think they can destroy an idea? We're all experiencing that, to think that here is an age of supposed progress and relative enlightenment, and yet we see so many thousands and millions of people still working from motives of revenge. And we must have gone through similar experiences in past incarnations. We should be able to have a sense, instead of shock and alarm, perhaps more of a sense of pity that the world still has to go to this type of thinking.
Yes. Yes.
We begin to get a resonance of experience of in many ways, and perhaps even be able to influence it in another direction on those planes without necessarily physically going out. And
I think that's a very good example, because even if Salman Rushdie is assassinated, as Ayatollah has called for, even if every copy of his book now were burned and the plates were destroyed, would the ideas which he has presented — I've not read the book, I have no desire to read the book, I imagine the sales have soared — but would the ideas, whatever they are that he's presented, would they be abolished? It's too late, isn't it?
Well, the fact that they were expressed means they're already there.
They're already there.
So expression is the last step, it's too late.
Yes.
What's ironic to me is that how we, you know, deny. I mean, this is a macrocosmic event, that even in ourselves, we tend to deny truths when it's presented to us. We can see in other people. What I'm trying to say is that we're horrified at the Ayatollah and the Muslim world being so up in arms about that, but yet, just a few months earlier, We saw people down in L.A. Going against that producer's house, and they were carrying banners, and they didn't riot, but it was just a slightly different mindset. They had something spokesman. They had something. It wouldn't have been very difficult to imagine that who the producer or other people connected with the theaters that the Christ movie,
Last Temptation of Christ,
had a contract out, a death threat, that type of thing for those people. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard anything in the news citing a parallel. So, you know, we can see things in other people, mm-hmm. but we have to look into ourselves to see how we're denying, how we're claiming.
This is what I mean again by experience, though. You see, let us say that the experience out of both of these things is really the same. We become angry. That's the experience which is our experience. To be angry. Whether it's angry at the Ayatollah for condemning Rushdie, whether it's anger at these people that have are upset over the Last Temptation film, whether it's anger at the film itself, the experience is that of anger. There are a multitude of ways which we may experience. But we have to deal not with the external, not with what Rushdie has written, not with the Ayatollah's response, not with the film The Last Temptation, not with Cousin Zakas, who wrote the original book, any of that. What we have to deal with, which is the experience we have to face, is the experience of anger.
But the